Fugitive.
Listen, everybody, especially you girls. Is it right to be left alone by the one you love and never home? I love too hard. My friends sometimes say, but I believe that a woman should be loved that way. But it hurts me so inside. Somebody, somewhere, tell her it's unfair. Can I get on with it? Can I get on with it? Can I get on with it? Somebody, is it right to be treated?
All right, somebody is going to need a witness, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Hi, everybody, talking Fugitive with Kitty and Bobby and Ken, back on for another 30 minutes of interesting discussion. Tonight is going to be part one of a discussion of the episode Trial by Fire, so that will include Acts 1 and 2. If you want to participate, as usual, 800-407-KSAB or talk at ksab.org. All right, kicking it off for part one is Bobby Neer.
Thanks very much, Dave. Before we get started, we should take note of the passing of Barry Morse about 10 days ago. He was, of course, a brilliant actor with so many credits to his name. We would be here all night if we even tried to list half of them. But most of all, to those of us obsessed as much with this series as he was with Catching Richard Kimmel, he was perhaps the most important ingredient in the success of The Fugitive. In 4 weeks, we will have the second part of our continuing series, comparing all aspects of the various fugitives one against the other. And on that one, the three faces of Gerard, we will speak much more of Barry Morse and what he meant to all of us. For now, we can just say that he lived a long and fruitful life and provided hours and hours of entertainment to millions. He passed away at the age of 89, still working as an actor and a writer as always. And we should note that at that age, he lived 40 years longer than his co-star David Janssen. If you wish to know more about this incredible man, you can buy his autobiography from a few years ago, or visit the Fugitive Views and Reviews, become a member, then go to our site and click on the file section. There you will find a brilliantly written four-part review of that book, written by none other than Kitty, who takes us through the various stages of Barry Morse's life, both on and off The Fugitive. Now, at last, for tonight. When singer Marvin Gaye sang tonight's opening theme song, Can I Get a Witness, back in 1963, ironically the same year The Fugitive started, he wasn't talking about Richard Kimmel, but he could have been, since if anyone needs a witness, it's The Fugitive. Poor Kimmel is a victim of his times, lacking any physical evidence and years before DNA testing and other forensic miracles even exist, he's in a near hopeless situation. I've said it many times before, this chase may be interesting, even thrilling at times. But so what? What does he do when he finally catches the one-armed man, and he starts screaming that he didn't do anything? So what is the next best thing? Find someone who actually saw the crime being committed and can link Fred Johnson to the night of the crime. Now, out of nowhere, comes just what Kimball needs, a man, an Omri officer, no less, supposedly above reproach, who claims he was driving behind Kimball the night of the murder, saw a man with one arm running from the Kimball house, and watched as Kimball almost ran him over. He didn't stop and investigate, he claims, because he was on assignment and on his way out of the country. Now, after reading about the murder in the magazine, he's back to save the day. All of this comes from Donna, who has enlisted the services of a new and savvy lawyer who is enthusiastic and rock-solid certain he can get Kimball a new trial on the basis of this new evidence. Everyone is excited, there is hope in the air, and I say, baloney. This isn't going anywhere. I'm always appalled at how the writers in the series either don't know how the criminal justice system works, or they don't care. I'm no lawyer, but I play one on this show, and I say the burden of proof lies with the prosecution, and Johnson, should he get caught, doesn't have to prove he didn't kill Helen. What is he going to the electric chair for, being in the neighborhood that night? Before we get into discussing this episode, one of the very best, a solid 10 all the way, let's consider why they even made it in the first place. It's early in season 3. Johnson will not confess to the murder until later this season in Wife Killer, which we've already discussed here. So we will come to know along with Kimball that, yes, he did it. Now show me the money. How does he prove it? if I'm the one-armed man and you find me and question why I was at the scene of the crime, I will simply tell you that I was indeed in the neighborhood looking to rob a home. Saw an open door, figured why not make it easy on myself, looked in, saw a dead woman on the floor, and ran away immediately. Why didn't I call the cops? I have a record. I'm a parole violator. I'm about to commit a crime. I shouldn't be anywhere near this neighborhood. Okay, you got me. Take me back to prison. But don't even think about taking me to death row. Kitty, am I wrong?
Well, yes, I do agree with you that the burden of proof is on the prosecution. And if the prosecution in this case is alleging that Richard Kimball killed his wife and there was nobody else in the house, you know, and one of the big problems we have, this goes back to the trial sequence itself in Girl from Little Egypt, we hear so little of what actually transpired in the trial. But to me, the trial episode leaves you with the idea that they proved that there was nobody else in the house. And this sheds light on the idea that, no, somebody else was in the house and somebody else could have killed Helen Kimball. Now, I don't think anybody is saying we're going to go find Fred Johnson and prove that he did it, but the fact that you can prove that someone else was in the house, I think would give, you know, at least some inkling to the jury to maybe say, well, wait a minute, maybe there is something to this story and maybe he didn't do it. I mean, because they don't necessarily have to prove that Richard Kimball is innocent, and they don't even necessarily have to prove that Fred Johnson did it, but it leads credence to his story, and I think that would that might give, you know, enough of reasonable doubt to render a not guilty verdict. I mean, at this point in the story, I don't think anybody really cares whether or not Johnson is caught and put on trial for killing Helen Kimball. I think the idea behind this is that there's a witness who corroborates Richard Kimball's story, and, you know, to, you know, because basically everybody went with the idea that this one-armed man was a figment of Richard Kimball's imagination and that nobody can corroborate his story. Well, here's someone who actually can corroborate his story. And I think based on that, and you know, and he's a reputable guy, he's an Army officer, and I think that would make a jury stop and think that, well, you know, maybe this guy really didn't do it. You know, maybe there is some reasonable doubt here. Because that's all you need to render a not guilty verdict is just reasonable doubt. Because when you render a guilty verdict, you have to say, yes, I believe this guy did it beyond a reasonable doubt.
And you're telling me that that jury didn't have reasonable doubt in the first trial? That they put a man on death row on the basis of a woman, a next-door neighbor, getting on the witness stand and saying she heard this couple arguing all the time and one day saw Helen Kimball with an injury, and they put that together and put a man on death row? You're gonna depend on a new jury to be any more fair than that? I think Kimball have to be crazy to go for this. Because just,
well, you know, remember,
they can always
petition a change of venue as well for a new trial.
Why didn't they do it the first time?
Well,
see, that's
because
the problem.
With a new trial, it brings up new possibilities.
Okay, let's see what Ken has to say about it.
Yes, I agree with Kitty on this one. I think you can open up a new trial if someone comes up and says, "Hey, I believe this Kimball story because
I'm not doubting they can get a new trial. I'm aware of that. That's not what I'm talking about. I don't care about the new trial. What I'm talking about is what the result is going to be. He gets a new trial. That's wonderful. But what I'm telling you is, well, go ahead. I should have interrupted you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying that if there was someone in that neighborhood that saw the one-armed man running from Kimball's house on the night that Helen was murdered, that is big, and that is huge. And this guy is credible. He's not just a hobo going down the street. He's a captain. I guess he has to prove he was driving on that street. You know, that's one thing. But you know what? This story is very unique in the series, really. I mean, we have not been introduced to this at all. You know, the opening scene, Kimball's on the phone, Donna, and a possible witness saw something. Actually, Eckhart didn't say. I was unclear. Maybe you guys can help me out. Did he say he saw the one-armed man run out of the house, or just running from the vicinity of the house?
I thought he said that
he saw him run out of the house, because I got the impression that he saw what Kimball saw.
Yeah.
That he saw the guy run out of the house and stop in front of Kimball's car as Kimball almost ran him down.
Can somebody tell me how it is that Richard Kimball is positive that the one-armed man killed his wife when he never saw him do it? I mean, since the series began, it's already assumed that he did it. Why? Because Kimball saw him run out of the house. You know what? There's a miscarriage of justice to send Richard Kimball to death row. And if they ever catch the one-armed man, it's going to be another miscarriage of justice, because I didn't see him do it. We don't see him do it till the end of the series. And so I don't know how anybody is so sure about that. I'm just trying to make sure that the one-armed man gets justice, too, because he deserves it. Everybody in this country is supposed to be equal under the law, and he gets the same break everybody else gets, but everybody wants to convict him. Kimball saw him running out of the house. Of course, he must have done it. And I don't trust the jury. And Ken, you're right about this. What you've been saying from the beginning when we started this program is that they did not do a trial at the beginning of the series, and that was like the worst decision that they made.
Yep.
There should have been a detailed trial taking up at least half that episode, showing us exactly what happened, how Kimball was convicted, what other evidence there is, what is lacking. Are there no fingerprints? Is there no evidence? I don't even know. Nobody knows.
You know, or at the very least, when they decided to do that mock retrial in Man in a Chariot, I think it would have been really good if we could have heard more of that Kimball trial in that particular episode.
That's exactly right. And they were too busy focusing on the old man and whether he was going to, prove anything to those students. So I don't see where, I'm not disputing any of this. And as a matter of fact, as we'll see when we come back in 2 weeks in Act 3 and 4, that indeed a judge does rule there should be a new trial. It's great. It's wonderful. I'm happy for Richard Kimball. But I got to tell you, if it's me, I'm not going to come back. I think that the odds are bad. It depends on, you have to assume that there's going to be doubt thrown on it, and the jury's going to say, no, we're going to let him go. Same thing applies. Gerard's going to be there. He's going to be, he's going to be scoffing at everything. He's going to say exactly what I just said, that it proves nothing. And you're going to go
through
this.
By the same token, he seems to have, this new defense attorney seems to be a little more intelligent than the one we saw earlier. I mean, the one named Girl from Little Egypt just appeared to be a deaf mute. He didn't say anything the whole time.
Uh-huh.
So you have to hope for the right jury. And unless this is the O.J. Simpson jury, I think you're going to have a lot of problems.
Yeah.
If they just, do denial and they simply say, this guy's, now, I will grant you this, if you get a new trial and you can bring back some of the people who Kimball has saved over the years he's been running, that might actually have some impact. Now, if you can do that, if they can come back as character witnesses and say, not only did this guy escape, he saved my life, he saved her life, he saved this life, he saved that, he's got me on the right track. I mean, it's unbelievable. That might make a difference. But I'm simply looking at it from an evidence point of view.
Well, let's not forget, Bob, that Eckhart has his wife and son to corroborate that he was in town that night Stafford, Indiana.
Yeah.
And that, that would be proof. He's not just making up this story.
So, Ken, let me ask you, if this is you, are you going to turn yourself in?
Well, it depends on the lawyer's recommendation, if I have a real good lawyer.
What?
And, I've been running around for 2.5 years. You know what? I take a chance. I do it.
Really?
Yep.
All right.
Well, we're gonna take a chance here, and I'm pleased to see Ken trust the wheels of justice.
Mm.
All right, we'll take a quick time out. We'll come back and continue talking about Trial by Fire when we have more Talking Fugitive here on Retro Radio.
The following conversation is real. It took place on Tuesday, June 8th of 2004, between a Blonde Star advisor and a subscriber.
Blonde Star Emergency.
Oh my god, I've lost my
myself in my car, and the keys are on the outside.
Ma'am.
Oh, my God.
Ma'am, I need you to calm down.
Okay, it's just that the windows are rolled up, and I'm starting to sweat. My keys are on the outside.
Now, your keys are on the outside of the vehicle?
Yes, oh, my God.
Now, does your car have automatic locks, or...
Yes.
Okay, here's what I need you to do. Take hold of the inside of your door handle there. Are you doing this? The shiny thing. Grab the shiny thing.
Okay, I've got it.
Okay, now give that a tug.
Okay.
Did it open?
Yes, oh my God, thank you.
Okay, now what is that noise?
Oh, that's my door alarm.
Yeah, but that only happens if the keys are in the ignition, hon.
Oh my God, you know what?
Your keys are actually in your ignition.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much, Blonde Star.
That's why we're here. Do you need anything else?
Blonde Star.
No, that's
always it. On, because you're always blonde.
All right, he's a witness, and I believe it sounds like he's got one at last. Okay, let's get back to the discussion and of the trial by fire, and we'll pick it up again with Bobby Neer.
Thanks. Well, I think based on what we just discussed here, we can make a pretty good case for Kimball not being in jail at all. But we are powerless at this point to do anything about it, and so is he. Which means that Kimball, if this doesn't work out, is doomed to keep running. Or is he? In Part 2, Acts 3 and 4, confidence is high, but reality intrudes and Richard is told that before anything can happen, he will be forced to turn himself in. A convicted felon does not get to appeal while he is on the run. So at least once in this series, they actually checked what the law is. And that's just what he does. Kimball boards a bus and heads right into Gerard's eagerly waiting arms. And to make matters worse, Captain Eckert turns out to have a few secrets of his own. 2 weeks from tonight on Talking Fugitive. Now let's get back to Act 2 and one of the very best Kimball-Gerard confrontations in the series. Gerard is pretty smart here for a change. Instead of creating a dragnet or trying to do it all himself in order to catch Kimball, who he suspects is back in the area, he follows Kimball's lawyer and finds out the hotel Kimball is in. And Gerard goes in, stops at the front desk to show the desk clerk his wanted poster. At the same time, Kimball's lawyer is frantically trying to reach him by phone to warn him that Gerard may be close by. He's close, all right. He barges right into Richard's room just seconds after Kimball has escaped via the fire escape. But Kimball is still in the street. Gerard goes over to the open window, calls him as he always does, then whips out his gun and fires directly at Kimball's back as he runs away. To make matters worse, when Richard hears those familiar words, "Kimball," he stops and turns around to see who is calling him. Who the hell does he think is calling him? This marks the one and only time in this series in which Gerard appears to actually be trying to kill Richard Kimball. In North Oak in Season 1, he fired his gun. That was a dream sequence. This is reality, and this is deadly. And if Gerard does shoot and doesn't miss, will he be in some kind of trouble for shooting an unarmed man in the back while he was running away? Kimball will not only be dead, but the series will be over, and what will we all do on Tuesday nights? Ken, what the heck is going on here?
I thought the scene was very good, how it played out. You know, Gerard comes into the hotel, and I love when they do the music. It's creepy music. And the hotel clerk there, you know, he had already plugged in the phone from the lawyer warning Kimball, but we don't see the lawyer and Kimball talk on the phone. We don't see it. Gerard realizes he's upstairs, grabs the key, and runs up. So we're all on the edge of our seat watching. But I agree with you, Bob. When he yelled out the window, Kimball turns around. I mean, why? If someone says, "Kimball, why do you turn around and look? You keep running." And then when he shot his gun, I thought he hit him. But nothing. He just runs away.
I'd like to know how he missed.
I don't know. I've watched it many, many times. You have, too. It looks like he was dead on and hit him right in the back.
Well, I have a screen cap there at our website at the moment, and you can see that Kimball is turned, running away, and Gerard has, you can see the flash from the gun, and he's pointing it directly at his back. He's not trying to hit him in the leg to stop him. And yet, imagine, not only does he do that, but there may be other people in the street. There may be kids playing in the street. A lot is going on, and this is most unusual for Girard to simply, I mean, he's had other opportunities and other stories. If he wanted to simply kill Richard Kimball, I believe he could have done it. And here he decides, well, maybe I've had enough of this. I'll just say, I mean, the way he just routinely shoots out the window is extremely shocking to see that. I was not expecting that, and unless I'm wrong, I don't remember any other episode.
Right. I think the writer goofed, because that was not the character of Girard to do that. You know, all the Girard scenes we've seen, he's not out to kill Kimball. He just wants to get him in the handcuffs and drag him back to Stanford.
Exactly. Kitty, what do you think about this? Is it shocking or what?
Oh, I guess when I saw it the first time, I don't think I was as shocked as you two were. I don't know why. I mean, I guess I was just thinking it figures Girard would stoop to this level. You know, when all else fails, just kill the guy. You know, that was kind of what I took from the scene. I mean, it's just kind of like he wants, you know, besides, if he takes him back to Stafford and he gets a new trial, heaven forfend, you know, Girard just might end up looking stupid because Richard might be found not guilty.
Does anybody think that Girard will be in trouble if he shoots an unarmed man in the back while he's running away?
Oh, I think he'd definitely be looking at some kind of suspension or charges or something. I mean, because any time, I mean, but then again, you know, I don't know what protocol was back in the 60s for shooting at somebody. I mean, maybe if you're maybe back then it was considered normal if you were trying to catch a suspect and they ran away, that you could shoot at them.
I rather doubt that because I can remember seeing lots of police dramas back in the 60s in which cops were always in some sort of trouble if they couldn't explain why they shot somebody, if there wasn't, the other person didn't have a gun, things like that. I mean, Kimball is unarmed and he's running away, and I just don't think that a cop has the right to shoot him in the back. Shoot him in the leg to try to stop him? Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. But it doesn't look to me like he's trying to do that. So it's a very strange moment in the series.
How about when he comes up to the and knocks down Kimball's door? I don't think Girard followed the proper police procedure there, because what he does is he bangs the door open and has his gun, you know, pointed out. I don't know if that's the right way to do it.
I don't know either, but you usually always see cops knock on the door first, and then stand.
What if Kimball's armed? What if Kimball has a gun? Yet Girard storms in there, thinking he's going to grab Kimball right on the spot.
I don't know. This is another issue in the series when you have so many different writers, and they all have their own take. I mean, it sometimes appears that writers don't do their homework before they go to write these stories. Don't know the character they're writing for, and often have him do things that are out of character. While we still have time, I want to go back to what we were talking about before and a little bit to the earlier part of this episode, especially to you, Ken, because I know how you feel about Donna, and it's interesting that Donna is the one who starts all of this by coming up with this supposed witness, and yet immediately she starts having reservations about it, does she not?
You mean in the office with the lawyer?
Yes.
Yeah.
She seems to be sorry she did it from the minute she starts.
Right. I like this, you know, phone call in the beginning, and I wish they had done more of this. You know, how did Kimball keep in contact with Donna? And did they write letters? Did he call once a while? And so, you know, to start the story this way, to me, you know, captivates me. You know, you've got the brother-sister relationship. He's on the run. Donna really cares for him, wants to help. And I just love that kind of drama when they do that.
But I would expect Donna to have the kind of enthusiasm for a witness the way that you and Kitty do, which is, oh, this is great. It looks like he's going to go free. We got a new trial coming up. And she's more like me. she's just, you know, wringing her hands and biting her lip and acting like, I don't know, it doesn't feel right. Gerard's got something, I don't know. It's just not going to work out. I mean, it's just, you know, I don't see any real enthusiasm there from her.
Yeah.
I will tell you this, I really like the lawyer who's really enthusiastic about all of this. He seems to know the law. And if he had been the only kid, now, you know, this is a different actor. This is Frank Letter, who was not in the flashback sequence. And with a lawyer like this at the beginning, he probably wouldn't have been gone to death row to begin with. Because this guy seems to know what he's doing. I will give him that if I was going to take the chance and turn myself in, that I would only do it with a lawyer who seemed to be this certain about everything. But I think this episode, more than any other episode, shows what a tremendous mistake it was to not go into details about what happened at the trial.
Yeah.
And
This is the only episode, I think, in the entire series that talks about someone else being around on the night of the murder.
That's right.
Until you get to the very end.
Right.
That's right. That's right. This is the only episode in which they do that. So I really think that was a mistake. And please take note, and Kenny and I have talked about this privately, if it wasn't a mistake to not have Kimmel actually see the one-armed man kill his wife or inside the house, then why did they change it in the movie version and the 2000-2001 version of the series? The series comes back, and in both versions, Kimmel actually has a fight with the one-armed man inside the house, right?
Oh,
Kitty?
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Right. And he has a fight with him, and so he definitely knows that he was in there, and he actually killed his wife. Now, you know that, from what I understand, Roy Huggins, the creator of the series, was a creative advisor, but he was alive back then, and he was a creative advisor in both the movie version and the 2000 version. So I don't know whether this comes from him or somebody else, who they must have taken a look at it and said, there's really a flaw here, a basic flaw, that today's audiences aren't going to buy into, which is that how can Kimball be so sure that the one-armed man is the man who did it? And I've been asking this from... I don't know, I've been for 4 decades.
But in Search in a Windy City, Johnson on the bus
has a
guilty look. You remember?
Wait a minute. I don't know
that he necessarily has a guilty look.
I thought he was just more surprised
to see Kimball.
Well, he's got somebody stalking him.
That looked like guilty to me. Come on, guys.
Oh, and that's gonna work at the trial too. Oh man, it's really gratifying to see everybody so confident about the American criminal justice system. Has it really been that long since OJ? I mean, I got to tell you. Everything just works out great. You just march in there and justice will be served. I don't think so. So I think the fact that they changed it in those other two versions shows that somebody was on their toes and said, wait a minute, come on. The guy says the one-armed man did it. No, he just ran from the house. You and Kitty may be right that there may be enough to get a trial and maybe a jury will say there's something here, but actually let a convicted killer go on the basis of this? I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it. I'm just not buying into it.
All right. Well, you're going to perhaps see it in about 2 weeks. You guys will all return to discuss part two, which will be acts 3 and 4 of this same episode, Trial by Fire. So to everybody else, thanks for listening. And we hope to have you back here 2 weeks. Will that be the 26th? And once again, we talk Fugitive here on Sherravision Radio.